Light rain rolling through the area, 58 degrees Kenosha, 55 in Racine at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. June is LGBT Pride Month, and from time to time during this month, I'll be dipping into the Morning Show archives to replay pertinent Morning Show interviews. This one dates back to 2015. On today's Morning Show, you're going to hear the conversation which I recorded with journalist Mark Siegel, president of the National Gay Newspaper Guild, founder and publisher of the Philadelphia Gay News, a prominent gay activist who was present at the Stonewall riots, who famously interrupted a live broadcast of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, and engaged in other very highly visible acts of protest. His new memoir about his activities through the decades is called And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality, published by Open Lens. Before we sort of take ourselves through the course of the book, I want to ask you, a pretty important overarching question. At one point, you say something to the effect that far too many young people in the LGBT community seem to have little or no interest in the origins of the movement, in some of the events that you and others were part of, that really laid the groundwork for what now is a very different landscape in which that community can live and thrive in ways that was just unheard of once upon a time. I wonder, first of all, if that is just the situation that is probably true of most young people about just about everything, that by and large, young people tend not to be sufficiently interested in history, no matter who they are or what community they are part of. Or do you think there is something especially true about the LGBT community in terms of, at least for some of them, a lot of them, their relative indifference to the history that you spell out in this book?
Well, I think it's a multifaceted answer, with primarily me ending up in the end saying that, yes, I agree most millennials don't care about what happened before them, but they need to learn, as we all do, if we don't understand history and how we got where we are today, it will repeat itself. And in our community, that's very, very, very true. Or you'll have opportunists revising history for their sake. And in our community, that's happened a great deal, especially this last past summer when people tried to make a claim that the gay rights movement was celebrating its 50th anniversary. That was a blatant lie. The gay rights movement in the United States happened to start in 1925 by a man by the name of Henry Gerber in Chicago, not in Philadelphia in 1965. Some people did very well by making that or assuming that was the case. But there's a more important question that this all brings about. When people such as myself and others of my age group try to talk about history and try to explain how we got to where we are, younger people aren't interested. And I think one of the reasons they're not interested is because our community suffers from something called ageism. Older people in our community are not respected. They're asked to move it alongside and let younger people take over as soon as possible. And I guess I'm seeing that nationwide. A lot of people think that some of the older candidates running for president shouldn't be running because they're old. And that's kind of sad. And I think that's another issue which I want to take on. I'm not quite sure how. I'm thinking about it. But I took it on when I was younger. When I was 18, I created a group called Gay Youth, because I felt youth weren't being taken serious as part of the gay rights movement. And we became part of a group called Gay Liberation Front in 1969. And that group is the group that probably should get credit for creating the gay community of what it is today.
We're speaking with Mark Siegel and talking about his memoir, And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality. Your book is largely chronological, and I actually really appreciate that, because I found it especially interesting as a history of your own personal life and a history of the movement. And I really appreciate the fact that you take us on a relatively orderly chronological journey here, which is helpful, especially for someone like me that doesn't know the specifics of this history as well as I should. The very first chapter begins with this sentence: I was an outsider from the beginning. Explain to our listeners the way in which that was true.
Well, when I was born, my first memories are growing up in a place called Wilson Park Housing Project. It's a Philadelphia-based housing project for low-income people, and we were the only Jewish family in that housing project. So in the early 1960s, if you grew up as the only Jewish family in a housing project, which was mostly Irish and Italian Catholic, you were treated to the likes of, it was your people who killed our Christ, you're so evil, you will grow horns. I was an 8-year-old kid trying to figure out how I was going to comb my hair around the horns that were going to be growing on my head. So, and my family, of course, we were probably the lowest leg of the family financially anyway. I understood discrimination, both, you know, anti-Semitism, social, economic. There was no way I didn't know discrimination. I mean, one of my good friends was 5 years old, a black kid, and I was told not to play with him by an uncle. And so I even understood racism at such an early age.
Hmm. Now, one of the things that I find most intriguing about your story is that your own parents seem to have stood in such strong contrast to so many of your other relatives. Although I probably shouldn't paint with too broad a brush here, but along the way, we certainly hear about a whole lot of relatives of yours who seem to have been and maybe still are fairly bigoted, fairly prejudiced, and your parents, on the other hand, viewed the world and certainly viewed you and ultimately who you were sexually, among other ways, with such openness and compassion and love. To what do you attribute that, the fact that your parents were and your dad still is who they are, in contrast to the families in which they were a part?
A very small answer and very quick: good parenting. In my estimation, and others I would believe, good parenting means supporting your children, always telling them that they are loved no matter what. They are loved, unconditionally loved. They're smart, they're creative, they're talented, and you want to show that as much as you possibly can. There was no doubt, no matter what problems I had outside the house, when I walked inside my house, there was no doubt that I was loved. I felt loved. I mean, my parents could be arguing. I still felt love. It was there. It was somehow you knew you were loved. And my parents, when I finally told them that I was gay, my father's reaction was, yeah, I sort of knew that, and here, speak to your mother. And when I spoke to my mother's reaction was, her only concern was, quote, I'm concerned that you'll be lonely in your old age. To which I answered, Mom, if I was heterosexual, I could be lonely in my old age. And that was about that's about what it was. And from that point on, my parents, in a sense, not only became supporters of me, but also of the gay rights movement, because I had to move back from New York, where I was living, because my mother got kidney disease and they needed an extra hand around the house. And I said, if I move back to Philadelphia, I'm going to be involved in the gay rights struggle in Philadelphia. And they said, fine. So in a sense, and I had no job, so they were basically supporting my efforts on behalf of the gay community. To the point where my parents marched in gay pride parades. My parents went on the Phil Donahue show. In a sense, my parents were some of the first LGBT allies that we ever had.
Right. I want to reiterate my question, though, which is they are in such stark contrast to so many of their relatives, your relatives, who were not nearly so sympathetic. And I'm still intrigued by the fact that they were who they were, in contrast to others in the same family tree who, I mean, in a sense, they're cut from the same cloth, but saw the world so differently. I mean, and fortunately for you, I mean, that you ended up with them as your parents and not...
Well, I not only ended up with them, I also ended up with a woman by the name of Fanny Weinstein, which was my mother's mother, my grandmother. Fanny was a firecracker, to say the least. She was a 4'7" woman who taught me an awful lot. It didn't matter where I lived, she was going to show me the world. And she did. This is a woman who explained to me how the family had to leave Russia because of the pogroms. This is a woman who explained to me why she was a suffragette and why she had to fight for women's right to vote. This is a woman who at 13 took me to my first civil rights demonstration. A woman who clearly tried to make me see the world and what it is and what all... And gave me hope for the future. That you compare that with an uncle who, when my mother died, and in her obituary, I'm quoted as saying that I consider her a gay activist. An uncle said to me, "Maybe it's good that she's gone," the day of her funeral, and that which made me realize, for the first time, of course, I had never considered what obstacle my parents were going through in the family while they were supporting me. And I, realizing that now, I can imagine the kind of things were said to them. They never, ever, they're both gone now, and never to their dying day did they ever say to me, "Oh, Uncle so-and-so said something or other, Aunt so-and-so said something or other." They just, whatever that opposition might have been, they kept it to themselves. They didn't want to hurt me.
One of the things that you talk about in terms of your early childhood is that you, like a lot of young people, did some of your first explorations of your own sexuality courtesy of the Sears and Roebuck catalog, or was it JCPenney? I don't remember which now.
Probably both.
But at what age was it that you started to realize that you would rather look at photographs of strapping young men in the catalog versus the scantily clad women in the lingerie pages of the catalog? At what age did this start to dawn on you that perhaps...
There was no age particular. I think I have always been like that. It just one day I woke up and said, "You know, I'm noticing that other guys are looking at girls and I'm looking at guys. That's interesting. That's different. I wonder why." That's about as far as it came. I mean, I always knew that I liked guys, but it wasn't. Many people think it's a sexual thing, but to me it was more of a romantic thing. I wanted to be good friends, close, and emotional with somebody. And I think many people make the mistake of thinking that are confusing sexuality with who we are as a whole being. Gay people aren't just sexual creatures. There's a lot more to us, which means where our hearts go, where our soul goes, and are we a good person?
So explain to our listeners what inspired you to move from Philadelphia to New York City, what it is you saw on a small little 9-inch portable black and white television set that told you, I am moving to New York City.
Well, when I was 18 years old, at that time, which was 1968-69, gay people were totally invisible. If you were gay in America, you were immoral to the religious community. You were illegal to law enforcement agencies. You were medically ill to the medical industry, and you were unemployable by the government. We did not exist. There was no internet. There were only three national television networks, no cable. And those three networks never had anything, and I mean anything, about gay people as characters or on the news. Zero. If you went to the library, most likely your library would not carry gay books that would tell you anything about yourself. So we were invisible, and we didn't know who we were. When I was very young, a PBS station, public broadcast, had a show called David Susskind. And late at night at 12 midnight or something or other, they had real live homosexuals on the David Susskind show being interviewed. And somehow from that, I saw that show late at night, hiding my TV so nobody would see me watching it. And I realized they were in New York. And so at 18, I stole away to New York on May 16th. I'll never forget that day because it's my favorite day in the world. And moved to New York. And 6 weeks later, I found myself in the middle of Christopher Street during the Stonewall riots. And that to me was the luckiest break I guess I've ever had.
Hmm. I so appreciate this second chapter called Stonewall, in which you, first of all, try to set the record straight about this incident and so much of the misinformation that has grown up around it. One of the most intriguing things you say is that it has been tremendously blown out of proportion, at least in some ways, I mean, in some descriptions of it. And yet there are other ways in which we still don't maybe fully appreciate the significance of the Stonewall riots. Help explain that.
Well, Stonewall riots changed the LGBT community of America for the good and created what we have today, or began to create what we have today. Before Stonewall, there was absolutely zero gay community. What you had gay bars, gay meeting places, private parties, and a few sporadic gay organizations like Daughters of Bilitis, One Incorporated, Homophile Action League, and a few others, only in major cities around the country. So basically you had maybe 100 out open gay people publicly in the nation. Up until Stonewall, there had only been 6 public demonstrations in the nation, none of them having more than 40, 50 people. That was it, lock, stock, and barrel. So along comes Stonewall. The first thing I say about Stonewall is, as you said, that it's been embellished and blown out of proportion, and it pretty much has. If you know the Christopher Street and Sheridan Square and that whole area, for the most part, on my recollection, and again, everybody has their own memory of it, and this is from my memory and how I recall it. And I've tried not to get involved in the various debates about Stonewall. But to me, it felt more of a circus atmosphere than an angry atmosphere, which is one of the reasons that I really despise the film. The film was one of the most, the recent film of Stonewall was one of the darkest translations of that evening that I've ever seen in my life, or the way we lived. I could be called one of the street kids of Christopher Street at that time. And my life was not, in that sense, depicted very well at all, nor do I think any of our lives were depicted well. And some of the figures are have the actual names, like Bob Kohler in the film has Bob's name, and Marsha P. Johnson has her name in the film. These were my contemporaries. They weren't just contemporaries. These were my friends, people I worked with. Sylvia and Marsha founded Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries. I founded Gay Youth. We were joined at the hip at Gay Liberation Front to work on getting our agendas through in the meetings. So these are close friends of mine, and the film does them a disservice. I think it does all of us who are portrayed in some way, shape, or form in that film a disservice. Because I don't think you need to embellish Stonewall for Stonewall to be the giant change that it was, because the reality is, from Stonewall, from that one night, and the one thing I did that night, which is thanks to Marty Robinson, he came over to me and said, here's some chalk, right up and down the streets, Stonewall tomorrow night. So I did that on the streets and the walls along with a few other people. We were called the Action Group. And that one little act created the second, third, and fourth nights of Stonewall, which most people don't know about. Now, those nights weren't riots. Those nights primarily were people coming out and speaking. I did not speak. I was not a speaker at that point. I was a young kid, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was learning. But those three nights ended with the formation of Gay Liberation Front. Gay Liberation Front probably was the most important LGBT organization to ever exist. It is also probably the most dysfunctional organization to have ever existed. But the reason it's so important is it did two things that are extremely important that had never been done in the LGBT community. First and foremost, we decided when we met to unite as a community and then define ourselves. Up to that point, we were defined by society. That means those moralists from the church. That means those police from the police department. That means psychiatrists, psychologists, lawyers. Everybody had an image of who we were. And we grew up knowing those images and realized, hey, that's not us. Let's begin to define ourselves and just tell society who we are. So in a sense, Gay Liberation Front became the first in-your-face LGBT organization. No, we're not who you think we are. This is who we are. Get used to it.
We're speaking
that
with...
That was the first thing we did. The second thing we did might even be even more revolution. We decided to create a gay community where there had never been one before. So in 1 year, we created the first gay youth organization, the first trans organization, the first community-wide medical alerts, the first community-wide legal alerts. We demonstrated. We got arrested. We then created the first gay community center. If all that were not enough, at the end of the first year, along with Craig Rodwell, we helped create the first Gay Pride Day. That is an incredible accomplishment for one organization so disorganized in 1 year, and is literally the building blocks of building a community. If we have a gay community today, it's thanks to Gay Liberation Front.
We're speaking with Mark Siegel about his memoir, And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality. I'm glad you characterized the Gay Liberation Front as you just did, because I was about to quote you. You write at one point in this chapter, Gay Liberation Front, in all likelihood, was the most dysfunctional LGBT organization that ever existed, which should not be very surprising. So what were some of the ways in which it was, as you say a little later in the chapter, total chaos in terms of the way they operated? And yet, how did you manage to accomplish all that you did, given that high level of sort of chaotic disorganization?
Well, first I got to say that not only were we chaotic, we were full of energy. The energy of changing society at a time of the counterculture 1969 year. And we wanted to be part of that. We had seen the black community fighting for its rights. We'd seen the women's community fighting for their rights, Latinos, and others. And we figured, why not us? And so that energy filtered through the room. But being counterculture and being from a group of people that were defined by everybody else but ourselves, we didn't accept any of society's privileges or suggestions. Therefore, when we went into a meeting, there was no president. We had a stick we passed around for whoever got it was the chair that night. There was no Robert's Rules of Order. The meetings were totally chaos because we were also trying to define ourselves. And in one night, you might have the lesbian separatists explaining how they've been oppressed their whole lives long by men, and they'd only be around men. And another night, you might have a feminist men's caucus talking about accepting their masculinity. And, of course, those two groups would probably be fighting and screaming at each other. On top of that, we're also trying to deal with a police department that wants to shut down gay businesses. We're also dealing with the fact that an attorney general's office is going to investigate us because we have a gay youth group, and young gay people are not supposed to be with older gay people. That's against the law in the state of New York. I'm the chair of the Gay Youth Committee, and we're just telling the government to go screw yourself, basically. All of this is going on and happening as we are trying to create a community center, trying to save people from committing suicide, trying to stop bullying, going out and speaking at high schools. It was one of the most chaotic scenes you could possibly imagine. One night, a woman got up and said that men wearing beards are only trying to show their masculine way of leadership, and it's oppressive to women. The following week, some men came in and they shaved their beards. to which other men were really offended because they said part of us understanding our own identity is understanding our own masculinity. So those groups got into a fight. I mean, you could fight about almost anything. One guy found one guy very attractive, saw him at Lincoln Center, and when he saw him, he walked up to him and gave him a kiss. When he saw him back at the meeting and tried to give him a kiss again, he said, "Oh, no, that was a public kiss for political reasons. I really don't like you."
but for the sake of attracting some attention and making a
Correct.
Statement, it was worth kissing him in public. Interesting.
Correct. Which befuddled the poor guy who thought
right.
he finally met somebody
right.
he could go out with. It was total chaos, but it was the greatest chaotic energy I've ever seen in my life.
You know, I'm glad at this point to ask you a question that I think is also really important, because you are describing all of this, and we haven't even gotten to the famous zaps that are sort of a next chapter of what you were part of. But just now, what you've described all sounds so exciting and amazing, and yet you say right in the middle of this same chapter, yet activism was not glamorous. Revolutions are work intensive, and that kept me living on a can of SpaghettiOs and potato salad for dinner most nights, and buying clothes usually at thrift stores when the ones we had were worn thin. Speak for a moment about the importance of reminding everyone that for all of the excitement that you were part of, and for all of the dramatic change which it generated, activism, even this kind of activism, was actually not all that glamorous. I think a lot of people would assume otherwise.
Well, and I understand why they would. Today, if you're a gay activist and you're working for a major gay organization, you're probably making a six-figure salary. Well, in those days, there weren't any jobs titled gay activist, or there weren't jobs where you could make any kind of decent living. I knew of only one person in the nation at that point who was making any money from it, or salary, I should say, and that was the Reverend Troy Perry. And that was about it. We who were doing the work got no salary, zero salary. And so therefore we had to find other means of living while we were doing our work. And that's not a complaint at all. That time to me is a golden time right now, and I adore it and love it. And I'm glad I had it. It taught me almost everything I had to know that my parents didn't teach me. My political being was taught to me there, in what I lovingly call GLF University. I've been able to do well with my life. I'm not wealthy, but I'm well off. And I get to look back at that time and think the fact is that we were fighting for a cause. Money didn't mean anything. Getting change meant something. And I think we did just that. When I was having those SpaghettiOs, it used to be SpaghettiOs and potato salad, when I was having that for dinner, it didn't bother me at all. I was thinking of what we could do that would better what we've already done, or what we could do to change the world a little in some respect, which, you know, I see those meager beginnings of the gay rights struggle, and I wonder today, I flash back and think, and we've talked, because there are several of us from that age that are still alive, and we often talk about, you know, did we ever expect to see what we see today, the monumental changes? And the reality is, no, we didn't. We are as shocked as everybody else in the country at how far we've come. And we're thrilled about that, but we also see how far we have to go. I mean, it's people who've been there, and know, you started off this conversation by saying, asking me about history and why people don't appreciate their history. The reality is if we don't know that history, we are going to continue it. And in this country right now, that's already happening. You can get married anywhere in the United States of America today, and 5 minutes later, in most of America, you can be fired for being gay. Most states do not have a non-discrimination bill, nor do we have one nationally. So you can be fired. If things were going so well, why would it be that, according to some surveys, 40% of homeless children are LGBT children who've been thrown out or run away from home? If we are as successful as we think we are, why is it that 20-some percent of all suicides in this nation are LGBT? Obviously, we have lots of work to do. It's not over. And the only way we're going to get that work done is if young people begin to realize that there's more to LGBT equality than getting married or being in the military.
We're speaking with Mark Siegel, talking about his memoir, And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality. Can I ask you a couple more questions?
Absolutely.
As you proceed through your gay activism, and as certain groups give way to new groups, the Gay Liberation Front giving way to the Gay Activist Alliance and ultimately to the National Gay Task Force, you begin talking about what you describe as a rather vicious divide in your community, which began springing up between people like you and then guys with alligators and polo emblems on their shirts, who saw the issue differently and particularly saw, in a sense, the agenda or the strategy options very, very differently from the way you and some of your colleagues did. Just say a brief word about that divide and how significant it was as a hindrance and or a help in this overall cause.
Well, for me, to me, that was a very personal divide that affected me in ways that are so outrageous. But what it really boils down to is classism. That organization, Gay Liberation Front, literally changed America, and it is the model of which we're working on today to create community. But because of who it was, and I was part of it, that piece of our history has literally been censored. Now, you got to remember, the organization was made up of people like me who were street kids. It was made up of trans people. It was made up of people left of center, because we were the only people who could afford at that time in history to be out of the closet. The people who were in the closets were the ones who wore those polo shirts, the one who went to work every day. And those people, as they were coming out of the closet slowly, didn't like our image. They did not want that image of who we were to be portrayed on the TV or in newspapers or in magazines. So slowly but surely, they began to censor us or modify our achievements into something that they could take claim for.
As you enter this next phase, you and your colleagues, and by this point you are in Philadelphia, you say Philadelphia became your own test lab for something, a new strategy which you called ZAPS, small little disruptions designed to really simply attract attention. What was the kind of attention that you were seeking? And explain to our listeners some of the first ways in which you went about creating these ZAPS to generate attention to your community.
I'm an Oscar Wilde fan. And Oscar Wilde once said, homosexuality is love that dare not speak its name. And I translated that into meaning that because of that, all the myths of society are believed, and we never get people to know who we are. I always believe that if they got to know who we are, they will learn that we're their brothers, sisters, neighbors, friends. We're just like the people next door. But they didn't know that. They thought we were monsters. So in order to change that, they need to put a face on gay people. And since most people were in the closet and wouldn't do anything crazy, I decided to do things crazy and get in the public light by doing disruptions of anything creative I could possibly think of, knowing, of course, that that would not make me very popular with the police, the general public, or my own community at the time.
And it's really interesting to hear about some of the nuts and bolts by which some of these ZAPS got put together. And, of course, the most famous of them was the disruption of the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, but many other zaps that preceded it. And, of course, one of the things that's so important to know is that for as spontaneous as they would sometimes appear to be, they involved an enormous amount of pre-planning. And that's one of the things that's most intriguing and impressive to me, that that those of you who were so young and inexperienced in a lot of these kind of matters managed to pull off some of what you did.
Well, I've always believed in nonviolence. I grew up in the 1960s when you could turn on your black and white TV set and watch Bull Connor attacking African Americans as they're, you know, just trying to fight for the right to vote or sit at a restaurant counter. So that was very important to me. Martin Luther King is a personal hero of mine. And so while in New York I might have been marching to free Angela Davis and be chanting, go right, go left, now pick up the gun. That was more like fun while I personally believe in nonviolence. And all my actions have always been nonviolent. So in order to make nonviolence work, if you're going to do a demonstration, you better scope it out. And the only violence that ever took place at any one of my disruptions was a reaction or overreaction by people on the scene, not my people. And if anything, we were the only ones who got hurt. No authority or public figure ever got hurt at any one of our events. There was one event which took place in Philadelphia where police beat one of my gay... The group was called Gay Raiders. One of my Gay Raiders, to the point where he was in the hospital for several weeks with his head split open. But aside from that one incident of violence, there was never violence at all. And the reason being is we would scope out the area of what we were going to do. We would watch if we were disrupting a broadcast, we'd watch the broadcast, see how it was done, see the camera angles, see when they went on break, try to figure out every aspect of it we could. If there was a studio audience, we went to the show several times beforehand to see how the show was produced. So with that kind of planning, you, for the most part, can take care of anything. When I was on a show and disrupting it, I would disrupt it. Usually, practically, I think every single time, I was wrestled to the ground, wrapped in cables. My job at that point, once that happened, was to offer no resistance whatsoever, to allow them to do whatever they're going to do, roll myself up into a ball, and allow that to happen. That's the easiest way to end a zap, in a sense.
At the time, did you have any misgivings that in attracting this attention, that to any extent it might be the wrong kind of attention, that by disrupting the CBS Evening News or the Mike Douglas Show or any number of other public events, that in the minds of some people you were creating a certain impression of what gay people were like? I mean, did you think about that a lot at the time? I mean, I think in retrospect you believe, and perhaps rightly so, that it was worth that possibility. But at the time, did you think very much about what kind of impressions will this create in the minds of people who see these zaps for themselves? Or did you weigh that even then and decide that it was worth it?
I think you hit upon what has to me been the most emotional part of the book for me personally to deal with. For two reasons. Number one, yes, I thought about that quite a lot. But what I thought about was the change I was making, which was important, which was people watching would get to see a gay person for the first time, and that meant that they would have to talk about us. And by talking about us, they have to talk about the person they just saw, which was me, and I'm not at all like the images that they had in their head. And that will open up the educational field to begin to have dialogue about us, which is what I wanted. The gay community, on the other hand, didn't want people like me to do things like that. And the wound that it has opened up for me as I wrote it was I never stood back and actually said to myself, oh, gee, if you do this, your own community is going to hate you. And now I have to come to terms with that. Now the community thanks me for all that work I did, But way back when, it really didn't like me for what I was doing.
Hmm. And, of course, one of the things that was interesting is that you ended up being one of the primary faces of gay activism and became a guest on various talk shows. And at that point, it was very important for you to adopt a very different sort of persona and be a serious, thoughtful, intelligent guest speaking intelligently about these really important matters. And it sounds like, at least for the most part, you were very successful in presenting a more serious address of these issues. For you, this was not just about attracting attention, but once you have that attention, doing something meaningful with it.
Absolutely. If you're, you know, you just can't be out there being a show. I mean, I think that Donald Trump is a show. He doesn't have any specifics, isn't clear about issues, and you won't get them. I wasn't a show, didn't want to be a show. I wanted to be a tool for change. And if you're a tool for change and really want to help society grow, you are able to explain it, and you're able to say how you can change it. And that was pretty easy to do. I talk about in the book, And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality. My publisher tells me I should get the name in as much as possible. so that's my contribution to what the publisher says. I'm also a good team worker, by the way. At least I try to be. On the Phil Donahue show, the first time I did that, the first issue, which has been upfront almost from the beginning in the gay struggle, has been that of religion. And I wasn't going to allow myself to be bullied by the Bible. I was not going to allow that to happen. I mean, mainly because I think that's a rude thing for anyone to do. And to take the Bible and use it as a tool for bullying, people should be ashamed of themselves to do that. It should be a book of love and Christianity and love, and they should be able to be used the same word almost. But people decided to hit me with that book, and I was prepared for that. And the objective there was to show people that one could accept that book and or not, if they wished, and that if you're going to yell at me about being a sinner, aren't you a sinner? In fact, if you read the Bible, practically everybody's a sinner because we all break some rule or other in the Bible somewhere. And I coined a phrase at that point called Bible a la carte, because people pick and choose what parts of the Bible they wish to follow. And at that point, everybody wanted to follow Leviticus. So anybody who reads Leviticus can find a gazillion things in there which proves that they break various biblical rules and are condemned to death. So I would look at the person telling me that I'm condemned to death, and then I would repeat back to them some parts of Leviticus and say, gee, if I'm going to hell, so are you. And that really shocked people.
Hmm. As you eventually shifted your attention towards the world of journalism, you ended up making what were probably some very important choices in terms of the kind of journalism you were going to create. Can you just say a word about some of the choices that you made as you first created the Philadelphia Gay News? Because some of the choices you made, to some extent, disappointed, maybe even angered some of the people of your community. But it was important to you to do a very high level of journalism, no matter what disappointment that might generate.
In the acknowledgement of the book, I thank various peoples for coming into my life at times when they did. In Philadelphia, I'm very lucky that a good deal of the journalists from Philadelphia Daily News and the Philadelphia Inquirer and a few other mainstream media outlets in Philadelphia had become friends of mine. And so when I took on the publishing venture, I went to them and said, okay, what do I need to know? What do I need to learn? Where can I find X, Y, and Z? And slowly but surely, they taught me journalism. And I wanted this paper to be different than almost anything else I'd ever seen in the LGBT community. I wanted it to be the best LGBT newspaper, which meant for me being a place where all members of the community, no matter whether they were right-wing, left-wing, center, politically, they could come and write their views. If they thought we we're wrong in an editorial, and we always put our opinion in an editorial. We wanted the community to know where we stood. If they thought we were wrong, we would give them the space in the paper to put their viewpoints. We wanted to make it a community-wide tool for communication with inside the community. And that was good on one respect, but what they didn't like is us showcasing areas of the community that they didn't want to see or they didn't want anybody else to know about. And they were surprised that, I guess, this comes from my Gay Liberation Front roots. I wanted to do hard-hitting stories that I'd never seen in gay press before. You know, we did the first story on lesbian nuns. We did the first story on homeless gay youth. We did some of the earliest stories on LGBT history. And something I'm really proud about is, as I go looking back at the early issues of PGM, is the stories we've always done about the trans community. They've never been invisible in my pages. And that makes me very proud. It's because right after Gay Liberation Front, all of a sudden, the trans community totally disappeared from the LGBT community because those men with the polo shirts and the alligators on their shirts didn't want them to be representing our community. So they totally disappeared. Not until the likes of Almost Caitlin did we see them again. And we're beginning to see what their issues are and hoping to solve some of those issues. But, you know, my paper wanted to talk about pumping parties and what some of the problems that real people in our community are going through. And we've done that through the years. I think that's one of the reasons that we've been so successful.
One of the things I appreciate is the courage with which you undertook this in early 1976. You write, "Never did I expect the battles that would follow over journalism. Our vending boxes would be bombed, and we would clean them up, repair them, and put them back. People would run over them with their cars, and we would again clean them up, repaint them, and put them back out. People threw bricks into our windows and sprayed graffiti all over our building. The death threats were something that we got used to. Me being put on the American Nazi Party's hit list in their magazine was a little more unique." But boy, it is chilling to read those words, and it helps us appreciate all the more that this was not fun and games in which you were engaged. It was deadly serious life and death business.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I credit Barack Obama with is that in his second inaugural address, he talked about the gay rights struggle in that very famous line, from Seneca to Seneca Falls to Stonewall. Now, I happened to be watching that, and that meant something totally different to me and a couple of other people who were watching it than it did to anybody else in this nation. What it meant to most people, it meant, oh, he's putting the gay rights struggle on the map. That's not what it meant to me. I got immediately on Skype and called my friend Jerry Hughes, who was also at Stonewall and a member of Gay Liberation Front. And the two of us just looked at each other over the computer and just started crying. And the reason we were crying wasn't because our civil rights movement that we have dedicated our lives to was being recognized by the President of the United States. We cried because we've always felt like the stepchild of civil rights movements. And finally, the President of the United States was picking us up and saying, "You are equal to everybody else." Mm. That was an important statement to us.
The memoir goes on to, of course, tell the extraordinarily important story of the emergence of AIDS and the cost of that epidemic to your whole community and, of course, to you personally as well. And the book, of course, goes on from there to all kinds of other exciting things that you have accomplished. A most remarkable life and a most remarkable memoir recounting just some of what you have been a part of in your long life. The book, again, is called And Then I Danced, Traveling the Road to LGBT Equality, a memoir by Mark Siegel, published by Open Lens. Mark Siegel, thank you so much, first of all, for writing this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I really enjoyed this.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for doing your homework. Always appreciate it.
It is
is coming up on 9 o'clock. We will join Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio for news starting at 9:01. We can give you the forecast details now from the National Weather Service. Cloudy and mild. We'll see showers off and on throughout the day. Right now they're off, but there'll be more throughout the day. And we're expecting a high of 71.